Welcome back to Tell It Anyway, the storytelling podcast that usually tapes in a little office above a butcher in Los Angeles. Today, though, is different. Today we're in New York in the studio at the Radio Foundation, and I won't lie, I'm a little nervous. The list of people who have recorded in here is pretty intimidating. For example, the Rolling Stones have been in this room, every single one of them. Jerry Seinfeld has recorded here, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, Amy Schumer, Chris Rock, Kristen Wiig. Back in the day, the late Ed Bradley used to record jazz from Lincoln Center here. And Alec Baldwin tapes episodes of his WNYC show Here's the Thing in this very room. So you may be wondering, what's little old Tell It Anyway doing talking into these gorgeous Neumann microphones? Which brings me to my first guest, Larry Josephson. Larry is a longtime public radio host and producer who runs a studio. He is a Peabody Award-winning radio broadcaster who helped define the medium of freeform talk radio in the 1960s on WBAI in New York. He produced and hosted Modern Times and Bridges, a liberal conservative dialogue on public radio stations, and he has produced the legendary folk group The Weavers and the legendary comedy duo Bob and Ray. He is also my dad. Hi.
Hi.
How are you
proud
doing?
Proud to be your dad. You may not be proud to be my daughter after this story I'm going to tell.
That's fine. I can handle it. I'm already sweating. This could be fine. Also with us today, all the way back from episode 2 of Tell It Anyway, is Chris Himes. Chris is one of those awesome people that we've known for 20 years, Matt and I, which means that we're all 21. I'm really excited to have Chris back on the show because he's now also a radio producer for the Eric Metaxas Show, which is on sort of Salem Communications, a big thing that also has Joe Piscopo morning radio show and all sorts of great stuff. Chris has previously worked at Yahoo with me and as a supervising digital producer at NBC, where he managed the digital footprint for Saturday Night Live, which led to a lot of late nights and a really crackerjack Lorne Michaels story. So this week we are talking about lost friends. That's the topic, which actually can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And so I guess we'll see where we end up. But I'm going to kick it off with a story about how I almost lost my best friend because of that one time that he got me lost. There's a whole legendary story. Do you know the story, Dad, about how we're sitting on his couch and there's clearly fondness between us. And I was telling him about the tree. Do you know that giant 100-year tree that used to be by Grandma Marion's place? You wouldn't know, but it was up on Pico or something. And he really wanted to go to the tree and take me to the tree. And it's because he wanted to, like, have a romantic first kiss under the tree. And I wasn't having any of it because I was just like, no. So it's fitting that we're here in the Radio Foundation studio because I was living, at the time I'm telling this story, just next door. And by just next door, I mean in my bedroom, Jenny's room. It was like 2001. And when I lived here in New York City, I would bop between places. I one time lived with our friend Ptolemy, Chris and I, our mutual friend Ptolemy,
yes.
Down on the Lower East Side,
yes.
in bunk beds, which yeah. You guys had assembled.
That's true.
Yeah.
like a pair of brothers.
Like a pair of brothers. And then I moved in when you moved out, and yeah. I became the sister who lived in the top bunk,
mm-hmm.
Which was very, you know, nice until there was no air conditioning. And then I moved out back here. So I come back, and then we had, unfortunately, in 2001 in September, a really terrible thing happened downtown. I was working at CBS News at the time, and I was really, like every single person there and every single person in the city, profoundly affected and stressed out and fucked up by 9/11. Everybody was. And I fell into the category of people who were not affected by it directly and so therefore could do nothing but watch smoke go and feel miserable and worry and think thoughts without having any direct connection or thing to do other than to work really hard. And so I did that from like September into October. And then I went and I was like, I got to get away. And at that time, I'd been dating this guy out in California. And he was someone I was a friend with in college. Nothing ever happened. And then we went out on our first date in March of 2001. No, April. I went out to Los Angeles for Uncle Simon's funeral. And as Matt has always been known to say, get them when they're vulnerable. this is Matt Flanagan we're talking about.
Predatory.
Yeah, very predatory. Yeah, I went to a funeral and I thought, I could use a laugh. And so I called up Matt and we went out. And so we had spent all that summer of 2001 just like going back and forth across the country because he lived in California and I lived in New York, just going on vacation. And we did a shore vacation and we did a Vegas vacation. We did all this stuff. But there was something about, and I remember very distinctly in August when we had gone to the Jersey Shore and I had walked him the last time you could ever do this to the gate. You remember when you could walk somebody to a gate? And we walked there and we sort of did that like long distance thing where we looked at each other across a table and we're like, I'm going to miss you. I'm going to miss you. And then I walked him to the gate and I waved goodbye. And like waving goodbye in August of 2001 was like waving goodbye to the entire prior life before that, because never again could you walk someone to a gate. And something about what happened here in New York, drove me completely crazy because I was working these night shifts that were going like hours and hours and hours, and made everything else that was light and lovely before that seem stupid and useless, including a summer fling. So Matt,
which I heard on your podcast, and I was deeply embarrassed.
Well, you just wait for it. And so now you know how it feels, by the way, to have someone who you're related to tell lots of private stories on the radio.
Well, you know that fathers never find out about their daughter's sex life.
I know. Well, and daughters should never have to listen to their fathers talk about relationships, so now we're equal.
Okay. And I feel like friends should never be brought into the middle.
So this is going to be real comfortable. Where's Matt? Where's Matt when you need him? So anyway, I borrowed the family car. I borrowed my mom's car. This is in October. And I'm driving up to Boston because Matt is going to be in Boston. And my stated goal of this trip is that I'm going to break up with Matt Flanagan because he lives in California and I live in New York and I'm exhausted and wrecked and feeling terrible. And I just want it over. I want to be completely miserable. I don't want any element of happiness in my life at this time. Driving up there and I'm rehearsing in my head all the things I'm going to say and do and get to Boston. You know, you just drive one. There's two ways to get to Boston. There's like a slightly longer way, and then there's 95. You could have those two choices. But then I realized, like, I have no idea where in Boston Matt lives. And in fact, I mean, let's set the scene. This is pre-GPS time, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. And so I call him because we at least had cell phones. I had made him get a cell phone over the summer because I could never reach him. It was like the voicemail on the answering machine that was like, hi, you've reached Matt and Herschel or Matt and Joel or whoever he was living with at the time. Our house is really dirty and we're not home. Like, whatever it was. I don't know what it was, but it infuriated me. So I made him get a cell phone. So I called him on the phone and I called him from my cell phone, which I, by the way, had had since 1997, since I lived in the house that had a cell phone since 19. What? When did you get your first cell phone?
The very first Motorola, the one that was the one-piece plastic phone that you held in your hand.
In a suitcase. Like, you had to carry it around.
Also, that was called a bag phone. I had two of those.
Right, right. So my dad had every phone that
Pioneer.
Went with you.
Yeah.
So I'm driving up there. I call him. I said, all right, what's your address? And he said, I don't know. Let me check. So he goes and puts me on hold and goes and asks his mom what the address is. She tells me. I said, okay. I said, how do I get there? I said, I'm coming up 95. You're in what town? He said, I don't know. I said, what do you mean you don't know? And in minor fairness, he had grown up in Wellesley and lived in Wellesley all his life. But his parents had, like, moved.
Got
so this was not his childhood.
Okay.
Home. Thank God.
I was getting concerned.
Yeah.
I was like, so you broke up with him,
yeah.
right? The man who didn't know where he lived.
Yeah, nothing in this conversation in any way, shape, or form is making me want to stay with Matt Flanagan at this point, because he's not conveying that sense of strength and command that I really needed in this time of, like, you know, national crisis.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to drive, and again, no GPS. I've got nothing going on, and I'm doing my best. And the where Matt actually lives is just the main road, but it goes through a lot of small little towns just to the west of Boston. There's Newtonville, Newton, Natick, Wellesley. There's all these little towns. And this one road just goes, but I was getting confused because I was like, I don't know when to stop. All these addresses are, so I call back. Matt, I am a little lost. Can you tell me how to get to your house? Long pause. No. It's like, what do you mean? I got so, so mad. And I think I yelled, which would not be either the first or the last time I yelled at Matt Flanagan. And I said, just put me on the phone with someone who can get me to your house, so in my mind, so I could break up with you and turn around and go back home. And I think he put me on with his dad or mom or someone who explained to me that I was on the right road and I should just keep taking it. And they explained, like, things that Matt could not, like landmarks and, like, how to go. So I finally get to the house and I am steamed because it's been a long ride and I've not slept. And I'm in that, like, hazy, awful, like, post-overnight thing where your eyeballs hurt and everything. And I'm just, like, sour and pissed off. And Matt just takes one look at me and says, well, let's go to the gardens of Wellesley College. I'm like, fine, I'll break up with you in a garden. I don't care. And so he turns us around and we get back in the car. I'm driving again. And he says, okay, just go straight. I said, I've done this already. I don't want to do this again. And we go to the gardens of Wellesley College, which are stunning, by the way. They have bridges. They have just foliage. It's like a, you know, 200 years of beautiful landscaping. We go in this thing. And now when I hear Matt's stories on this podcast, too, I think, like, how many other ladies has he taken to the gardens of Wellesley?
But it seems like there's a theme of Matt wanting to take people to trees
or arboretums.
Yeah. Got a real green thumb.
Yeah, he really he likes a setting. Matt likes a dramatic landscape for whatever. And I'm sure at some point in this drive up, I had prefaced this visit with, we have to talk. Mm-hmm. And so he sat me down in this very nice area. And I said, look, this is just, I was in, like, tough girl mode. This is just, like, you know, it's a really great summer and everything was really great, but things are really bad right now and things are really serious and we, this has just got to end. Because where's it going to go? Just, like, really mean and hardcore. And he was like, well, okay, you know, it can end. But, and he just sort of, like, talked me through it. He said, I think maybe you might just be feeling a little more upset about what's going on in New York than maybe me. And I have to tell you that I really like you. And I don't want this to end. And I was like, well, fuck you. You know, it was in so, like, altered state. But he talked to me some more and he just, like, really sort of very calmly made it very clear that he didn't actually want the relationship of, I think at this point it was what, April to September, like 5 months? To end. And that was, like, a real statement. And so I was like, well, fine, I'll give it another try. And then, you know, we hung out in the nice garden, very pretty, whatever. And I drove back. And oddly enough, I started to feel better. And I remember going back up there for Christmas. And he gave me this, like, a Tiffany bracelet.
Mm, fancy.
I know. And it said the words on it, falling. And then after that, 3 months later, I'd moved out to California and we were together. And I always think about that when I think about, like, major turning points in life, which is that if I had been just a little bit more tired or cranky or whatever, or if he had been just a little bit less determined that he thought this was actually a real thing, I'd just broken up with him like I did every other guy before that. And, you know, gone on my merry way through New York City and probably never left. And
yeah, it would have been terrible.
I know. I know. It would have been. And I think about who I would have been now here in New York, probably still doing the overnight because, you know, I would have had those like horror, you know, I just would have been, it would have been awful. So anyway, I don't know. That's my story about how I almost lost my best friend because he almost got me lost.
Well, some of my most passionate relationships began with fuck you.
Right.
It really is very cathartic.
Yeah. It's funny because a lot of people I know do not yell at their significant others. And
they can't be Jews or Italians.
I don't know. Like, it's just like you don't yell. You just, like, quietly steam.
Yeah.
Are you? Where's
No. I'm like, half Cuban, and the other half is, like, Irish and German. And,
okay,
you
so
know.
You're in the...
Yeah, no, we try not to scream too much, but she's, like, Lithuanian and...
Right.
You know, some other
So there's
stuff.
No so, silent
yeah.
stewing.
No, there's some more, definitely some warring that goes on.
Right. But that's, I think that that's a good thing. Like, people are always mystified, too, when we got comments of people like, I can't believe you guys talk about your old relationships.
Yeah.
Like, to each other, not even publicly, but, like, mm-hmm. to each other. And I'm like, but that's history. I don't know. So, anyway, that's my...
Well, this podcast would go on for 4.5 hours if I talked about my old
Right, yeah, you, yeah.
This is getting good.
Yeah.
I want to hear about this.
Yeah.
Can we extend the runtime of this one?
At age, at age 36, I reached my limit with significant others of my parents.
Mm. And I never heard about any of them.
I know.
And One football player I met at your mother's house who had rocks in his head, but
right.
that's the only
No, he was really, no. See, everybody
this
wants to bag
good.
On the football player. He was the son of a preacher. He was very smart. He was
What was his name?
Dave Stout.
Dave Stout.
No,
sorry.
You can't be
hey, Stout goes back, throws the ball for a touchdown.
Ooh. He was such a kind, wonderful, funny, smart guy who's now in marketing, has a beautiful wife and daughter, and I still stole his football jersey.
No,
I have a bin in my garage that's all like old boyfriend shirts and sweatshirts.
Trophies.
I keep trophies, like Hannibal Lecter.
Or the Predator.
Yeah.
From Arnold Schwarzenegger.
A cave full of trophies. So I don't know. I just, I always think about that in terms of like a tipping point of alternate reality. Of what life would have been. I mean, I don't know.
Like sliding doors in Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yes. Like Matt Flanagan. Like if I had really ended up in Framingham or Marlboro, like it would have been toast. But that's not the first time I got lost in that area. My friend Andrea used to live up there, and me and her boyfriend, who ended up being her husband, would drive up, and her mother would be trying to give us directions, again, pre-GPS. And she says, you know, we're right after the causeway. You just take the causeway. And Paul Sclafani and I are looking at her and go, what the hell's a causeway? And we couldn't, like, identify it in the darkness. And as it turns out, it's a bridge over water that doesn't, in the dark, look like a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
So we could not figure. We must have gone over that causeway.
It's also known as a Simon and Garfunkel.
Yes.
Like you were a rebel with a causeway.
I was a rebel with a causeway. So, yeah. So I have many, many good friends from Massachusetts. Like a startling proportion of my really good friends come from Massachusetts. And mm-hmm. I think it's because they have a habit of being honest and straightforward and with amusing vocal variety.
But in certain neighborhoods, they cut your throat.
Yeah, no, I know. I didn't have friends from Southie. My friends were not in The Departed. They were in the burbs.
By the way, the worst driving experience I ever had in my life was driving in Boston in a blinding snowstorm on what I found out was Commonwealth Avenue, trying to get to Cambridge. And it turns out that Commonwealth Avenue has no signage that says Commonwealth Avenue. None, at that time anyway. And I was going, and there were no cell phones either, and I was darting into gas stations, and they looked at me like I was a criminal or something. I finally found it, but it was horrible.
Yeah.
Boston is one of the toughest towns to drive in.
Mm-hmm. They don't mess around.
No.
And then the funny thing is that Matt's father, John, when I drive, he's like, oh, you're a crazy driver. Like, you're from Massachusetts. What are you talking about? Oh, you really got your foot on that gas, eh?
Country road.
All right, well, things I'm going to regret include asking my father to tell stories about lost relationships. Yeah. But let's see. Is there a table I can hide under? Let's see.
Oh, there's a closet right there.
Yeah, let's give it a go. I might end up in the closet. Chris, you'll finish this one out.
Yeah, I'll bring it home.
All right, Larry Josephson, okay. Tell us the story of your lost friend.
Well, where do I begin? I'm 76 years old in the assisted living demographic, but I'm still going, still running this company and doing a bunch of other things. And over that period of time, also I'm a loner. I don't make friends. Your mother is very good at making friends. You can sit next to a stranger and suddenly become a best friend. But I don't do that. And in fact, I shy away, go the opposite. And I was a loner as a kid. Never had a girlfriend until college, and it was platonic. And I have pushed dozens of women away for one reason or another. I can't stand women who are loud or talk all the time.
What?
Sorry. Well, you're not a girlfriend. Anyway, so, and many friends have disappeared over the time from college till now. Some have died. My best friend Steve Post died about 18 months ago. Some others have died. Many of them are married and consumed by their marriage, or they're consumed by work. They work 18. My best friend Marty works 18 hours a day. And in the old days, which is in the 70s, my good friend Spalding Gray and I would sit in Central Park on a park bench and just talk, or I listened to him talk, actually. He had a shrink up the street. And that doesn't happen anymore in my life. In fact, I'm going to see a venture capitalist I know to see if I can patent a new app called the Park Bench.
Yeah.
Because so where do we get? I am kind of embarrassed to tell this story in front of my daughter, but what the hell? I'll never get a corporate or government job after this, but who cares? So I had a friend whom we'll call Ted. That's not his real name. And we were very good friends. We met on a panel, a grant panel, and we really hit it off. And he was Irish and just the general sort of the opposite of black Irish.
Right.
He was engaging. He was funny. He laughed at my jokes, which is, by the way, my ultimate criterion for friends or girlfriends or wives. They don't laugh at my jokes. Goodbye. So Ted and I hung out at different places. Well, and he was married and he had a child. And one of the places we hung out was a dive bar, but it was more than that. It was not even a titty bar. It was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. It was right on Canal Street.
Right.
It was called Diamond Lil's. You could just walk in. Didn't need a secret handshake or anything like that. And the girls not only pole dance, but they dance naked. And if you
I didn't know that was allowed.
Well, it isn't.
Yeah.
They obviously paid off the police and the health department and a lot of other people and the state liquor authority. And the rumor was it was mob run. Anyway, and all kinds of people came in there, city employees in suits and ties and working class people and so forth. Anyway, what went on there, and I'm really embarrassed to tell you this, is that not only are they naked, but if you gave them a $5 bill, this is back in the 70s, you could touch them.
Oh, my God.
And also—
For $5?
Well, that was, 1970-something money, but maybe it's 10 now, or it would be. Anyway, and you could eat them. They would sit on the stage, and you could,
What?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Now, I never—
And where is this closet again?
No, it's not a closet. It was a bar right on Canal Street.
God.
And Mayor Ed Koch, the great Puritan— closed all those, all the lap dance places, closed them all down.
Yeah.
So
and the Mayor Giuliani closed down the ones that were left, and we got Disney Times Square.
That's right. Yeah. So anyway, and I would go there. I consider myself an urban anthropologist. I would go there and observe, and sometimes I would buy drinks for the girls and elicit their stories. And there's, I've been in a number of these places, although not one like that.
Right.
They're just basically lap dance places. Sometimes they're naked, sometimes not. Anyway, depends upon the precinct, the police precinct.
Right.
So I would sit with these girls and try to get their stories because I'm a storyteller. And the most amazing person I ever interviewed, this is a far out in Queens.
Did you bring a microphone?
No.
Okay.
They wouldn't talk to them.
This is just for generalized research.
And I don't generally do that. I recreate their stories, as I am doing now. And one girl who danced naked in this bar way out on Queens Boulevard was a Jewish girl from Queens College.
Oh, my God.
I couldn't believe it. What's a Jewish girl? You know, okay. You're not supposed to give it away, or for $5, you're supposed to, like, hold it out in front of your husband until you get a mink coat or a car or whatever it is you want. So I could.
Feminism.
Oh, well, okay. I'm sorry. Most of the people who've worked here are women, and I like women, but I'm not a feminist. I've been, in a certain period of time between marriages, I was very lonely and feeling sorry for myself. So I'd go to these places and talk to people and watch what went on. Occasionally, maybe I'd buy a lap dance. But I've never ever seen in any place in New York City or anywhere a place like Diamond Lil's. And Ted and I would go to this place and observe and maybe touch or something. But I would never eat them because my mother told me that Gentile girls had diseases.
Oh, my God.
And I wouldn't do it anyway. I'm kind of timid. But I wanted to watch. I couldn't believe this place existed. So anyway, and this went on and on. And I went, like, upstate to his cabin with his family. I got very close to his wife and his kid and so forth. And it was just a great, great male friendship. And then one day I found in a card shop a little postcard that says Diamond Lil's on it. And I sent it to him. And I never heard from him again.
Oh, my
and,
God.
And I think the friendship was also based on the fact that he kind of wanted to get away from his wife and family, although right. they were beautiful people. He had his problems with relationships, too. But I really regret that. And once in a while, I'd run into him. How are you? How are you? And but nothing was left. And I really regret that. And, you know, many of my old friends are either dead, crazy, deeply involved in their marriages or their work, or loners,
right.
like myself. So, and it's very hard to make new friends when you're my age. It's just, right. I'm not in college. I don't hang out in bars except Diamond Lil's. I don't go to all the places where people, and even when I go to parties or in my synagogue, I will, by the way, when my rabbi hears this, I will be excommunicated right. from Judaism. But,
right. Well, what will the rabbi do if you give him $5?
I don't know. Probably circumcise me again.
Oh, God.
Well, actually, I was in a parking lot in Long Beach, California, and I was coming back alone from some diner or something. And this couple was walking towards their car, and he said, well, you know, in this life, you're circumcised only once.
Oh,
I heard that.
Hmm.
And I sit in restaurants often alone. Most of my life I spend alone, and I sort of over-listen to conversations that are mm-hmm. going on behind around me. And I hear some amazing, the most amazing one was actually a place on Madison Avenue where these two women, 40-ish Upper East Side women, well-dressed, you know, kind of having a girl's night out. And one of them says to the other, well, I'm auditioning new boyfriends. And she's, oh, yeah, and really? And this went on. And I wanted to say, well, where does one apply?
Right.
But I didn't, because I frankly didn't want such a woman in my life. But so if you'd like to be my friend, write the P.O. box.
Well, you've had a lot of really great friends.
Yeah.
And the grand old age of 38 into 39, I can sort of see the beginning of the end of many friendships,
yeah.
which is people go. And I would say that you, Chris, are fairly remarkable in that you've had your fair share of children.
Yeah. I have, yes. Yeah. Yes, this is true.
Yeah. We're up to six currently.
That is true. I have six children.
But yet you have not disappeared off the face of anyone's map. And I guess that is a credit to Tiffany, but also just sort of a credit to trying to stay present, because so many of my friends that have kids, it's like the great wall of playground.
Hmm.
And
they don't have time.
They don't have time. It's a demanding gig.
I know.
And
also in some marriages, if you're the third person, a woman, the wife hates that. Or it's very hard to do that.
It's a, it becomes a weirdly different kind of balancing act. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed, I've just seen the beginning of, and also in LA, there's a particular condition in Los Angeles where everybody leaves. Like everybody doesn't want to stay there because they can't raise kids there or it's like the career thing doesn't work out. And so they all move away. They move back to their hometown. They move to someone else's hometown. They move where they can buy a house like a normal human. And I and Matt and I are still there like, where have all the friendships gone? Exactly. You know, we often talk about like, oh, yeah, remember that time with Trinity and Michael and Jess and Mike and all these people? And, well, they're not here now.
You it's know. Like that sad scene in Les Mis.
Yeah.
Empty chairs and empty tables.
So true.
Baby Bjorns in Volvo station wagons. Private schools and houses with backyards.
But you must have a very not only nice but accommodating wife, because I know a lot of wives who kind of, they don't disallow it, but they kind of make your life miserable if you go out with friends, men friends, or God forbid, women friends.
Yeah, I think, my wife's pretty okay
she's
in that regard.
Rad.
Yeah, she's pretty
awesome.
She's pretty good. I think it took me a little while, like, you know, when we first got married and we had kids, you know, pretty quickly. It took me a little while to kind of figure out the balance of that, like what that looked like.
Right.
And so I think it's more like if she knows I'm sort of coming from a good place, she doesn't really care, you know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I just.
By the way, I think you stopped at 6 because you figured out what was causing it.
Well, you know. Apparently.
You guys are good at the job.
Well, we had, you know what it was? We had a set of 3 girls very close together, and we thought we were done. And I thought, well, I just must make girls, and that's that, and I won't have a son. And I found myself sort of inappropriately enamored with my friends, like, you know, toddler son, being like, hey, you want to throw a ball? You want to play Spider-Man? And I could tell my friend kind of gave me, I was like, I need to get one of my own.
Yeah. You got 2.
Well, yeah, now I have 2. There was rum involved, really, for the 2. And we have a little baby girl. So yeah. I think that's it. But I like the children I make. I don't know.
That's great. Well, I do too. You know, there's a belief, and sort of an old wives' tale that came out of rural England, that if you have sex facing north, you'll have girls, and facing east, you'll have boys.
Oh, my God. This is why.
Now, what if it's north, but you sort of face east, biologically speaking?
I don't know.
Then you get a dolphin.
that's pretty good.
I don't know what the solution is. I guess you get more friends or different friends, or you just start liking things on Facebook, like.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can do that. I think... Yeah, I think you have to have a deliberateness, a intentionality to it, because the natural order of social interaction is like anything else in the universe, and it's the second law of thermodynamics.
Right, things move apart.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. You have to be intentional. You have to put in effort.
Entropy.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I think all your
friends. Speaking of entropy, I'm writing a social history of this era called "There's No Time to Pee."
I thought it was no rest for the restroom.
Well, there's no rest in the restroom is another one.
But you've had incredible friends, Dad. Like your friendships are legendary.
But one of them, for example, that I was very close to, I met him at WBAI and then became friends with him and his wife. He's in another marriage now, which is very difficult. Mm. And he'll call me once in a while, but he's obsessed with this woman who, I don't want to go into too much detail, but he wants to get out of it, but he can't, and all of that. So I almost never see him or hear from him. And there are many like that.
Well, the script becomes the same. That's what I find.
Yeah.
The script of each person's unique misery can sometimes be like a repeating tape.
My best friend, Dennis McDougall, who lived in Long Beach all his life or around there, one day got up and said, I'm fed up with the 405 and I'm going to move to Memphis, where his wife was from, or his wife's son was. And he's been in Memphis ever since. And I was there once at a convention, but I've never got down to see him. In fact, the convention was in Memphis, and I went to Elvis's tasteful home.
Right. Right, tasteful Graceland.
Graceland. And
tasteful cottage.
Oh, they have wonderful, they have zebra striped couches, and they have all kinds of animals, and
I believe Trump referred to it as understated.
Very good.
I was just thinking, like, what would the Colonel do for you for $5?
Colonel Sanders? The Colonel?
Colonel
Elvis
Parker.
Is Colonel Parker.
Oh, right.
$5, you can get like 10 pieces of chicken, too.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the other Colonel.
Which you can also eat.
In dear old New York, it's remarkable, very. The name on the lamppost is unnecessary. You merely have to see the girls to know what street you're on. Fifth Avenue beauties and dear old Broadway girls, the tailor-made shoppers, the Avenue Eagles. They're strictly all right, but they're different quite in the different parts of town. In old New York, in old New York, the peach crop's always fine. They're sweet and fair, and on the square, the maids of Manhattan for mine.
Well, this room has contained greatness and stories of $5 chicken.
Yeah. And now I'm really embarrassed to tell that story.
That's all right. That's what the whole show is called,
right.
Tell It Anyway.
These cables aren't connected to anything.
That's fine.
Yeah, that's true. This is
I'm
all
not
good.
Really recording. It's just a podcast. Well, what am I going to do? I think I can only turn to Chris Himes to tell me a story of lost friends.
Yes.
All right, Chris Himes, take us home with class and substance.
All right, I'll do my best. So my story is about a lost friend who's still alive, but it's kind of like what your dad Larry was talking about. People's life situations pull them in different places, and it's... Yeah. So when I was, I think I was 13, my mom passed away from after a long bout of cancer. And that was hard. But I had a good friend who I think we'd been to school a year before that. But anyway, he ended up kind of becoming my best friend all through middle school and high school. His name's Tom. And he's a great guy. But he was the first, in seventh grade, we used to have these projects. We went to sort of a small parochial school, and you could write essays or what we had sort of these theology classes or Bible classes we had to do assignments for, and people would write papers or do like, you know, spend 3 weeks like, I don't know, macrame in the Ten Commandments or something like that.
Right.
And one of the options was to do a video. Hmm. And it was around the time that they had these video rental stores. It was pre-Blockbuster called Errol's Video.
Right.
And you could also rent these giant VHS cameras for, I don't know, something like $20 a day or something. Wow. It was kind of expensive, but you got the whole kit and, you know, you could do it. So we waited till the last minute to record one of these videos. And it was kind of like a guerrilla production of, I forget what the assignment was. I think the first one we did was possibly for English class. And the sketch premise we came up with was Geraldo interviews William Shakespeare. So it was highly Monty Python influenced.
Good.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be Lorna Doone Does Dallas.
I think
we would have gotten expelled. But Tom had introduced me to Monty Python. So he was kind of a comic
He was my comic buddy.
He was my first writing partner,
guider.
Really.
Yeah.
So we started basically producing comedy, but guised as school projects. So we went on to do, we went on to do Julius Caesar, which was a lot of fun. We filmed the stabbing things. We always sort of would enlist classmates to be extras in them. Sometimes we'd have a dozen, you know, students in these things.
Like a full-fledged
We did
pitcher.
The Crusades, which was kind of very influenced by Princess Bride. Mm-hmm. So we were sort of talking in big voices and weird lisps and, you know, we thought we were hilarious, but our teachers loved it. And so we would get 100% on anything we would do, and we'd always do it literally the night before.
Yeah.
That was sort of my relationship.
And that's one of the best papers I've ever written were done the night or the day before.
Yeah, I inherited that from you.
Yeah, I've been trying not to pass it down to my children, but I don't know how it works exactly. But I think they're screwed. But I think the crowning project we worked on was the story where Jesus goes into the temple and he's upset with the money changers and he feels like there's this commercialization going on. So he he tips over all the tables and gets very angry. So we decided, my dad...
I love that scene in Jesus Christ Superstar, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, that is my only reference for Jesus, is Jesus Christ Superstar, the musical.
Yeah.
As good as any.
That's pretty much it. It's just angry Jesus, which you don't get to do. But as a eighth grader, you're like, oh, let's do that. Yeah. So it was very Patrick Swayze in Roadhouse. I played Jesus, and I came in. If I had a mullet, I probably would have, I would have used it. But it was very kung fu, kind of Patrick Swayze, Roadhouse,
punk rock Jesus,
and pretty violent, and very. We felt like it was true to the essence of the story.
Right,
maybe not.
Right, right.
But, and somehow we got an A on that, and we didn't get in trouble. That was sort of like skirting the line. We were like, they're going to be upset about this. But anyway.
Was that a Catholic school? Or?
Yeah, it was like a Catholic
That's why you have six
school.
Children.
Yeah, something like that. Although I'm Protestant, so technically I'm an idiot.
You won't get into heaven.
Yeah, the Catholics. Anyway, that's another podcast story. But... Tom and I were just kind of, his mom was the band teacher, so mm-hmm. we played the same instrument in band. It went to a small school, so you could do like, a bunch of different activities. You could be I was on the baseball team. I was on the basketball team. I was in student council. I did band. My wife still makes fun of me for being in the marching band because she went to a normal school where that's actually very nerdy.
Cool.
It was actually very, for those of us in the know, we realize that it's very cool.
Mm-hmm.
So Tom and I were, in that together. And we played the same instrument, euphonium, which looks like a small tuba.
What's a euphonium?
It's like a small tuba.
Oh.
It's the same. So a lot of times when boys play trumpet, they'll get braces. And then the band teacher says, well, why don't you switch to euphonium? Because they don't have to relearn it.
Right. And it's a bigger mouthpiece.
That's right. That's right. So I've codified myself as a nerd forever in the annals of this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we would perform in student talent shows, so we would do Wayne's World together. It was kind of just like any excuse we could do, have to do any kind of comedy, we would do it. And then we had a lot of fun doing it. And when I went to college, we had a fun experience where I kind of discovered that I wanted to do comedy, write comedy. Yeah. And I don't know if you remember the David Letterman story. Well, basically...
I mean, I know another David Letterman story.
Yeah. Well, which one?
I know the one where Matt got beat about the head, neck, and shoulders working for that job, but I don't know yours.
No. It's basically I signed up for, an email address my first or second year of school. Maybe it was third. I don't remember when it was, but I went to college for 6 years. So if I sound confused, it's because I don't remember. I'm not a normal person. I can't just say the fourth year. It's like my third junior year, that kind of thing. But anyway, I believe it was my third year. We all got emails, student emails, and there was this thing
called... Isn't that weird that we got email?
Oh, I know. So weird.
Like in college for the first time ever?
And it was bizarre.
Weird.
So they would have, they had a sort of these message boards. It was like pre-message board message boards called Usenet or listserv type of things. And they had one devoted to The Late Show with David Letterman. And the show would actually post, or I think it was a super fan would post the top 10 list every morning, and that would get emailed out to your email address.
Right.
And so that was like one of the first big message boards or lists that people were... they thought they were so cool, but it's just like getting a text from, But there was a producer from your old company, CBS, who put out an email saying that she was a 48 Hours producer, and they were doing a story on David Letterman's internet following. And then, what is this thing? We hear people are getting... People are getting the top 10 lists, during their lunchtime at work, this is an interesting phenomenon. So they wanted to promote it and find out what it was. And who are you people out there? And so I kind of wrote this really, I oversold my computer skills. I was like, I've been on here for a long time. And it just so happened that I had found, there was another person who, VP, you remember VP?
Yes.
An old friend of yours, he had two tickets to go see Letterman in New York. Somehow, and couldn't use them because he was in school in Florida or abroad or something like that. And he was going to give them away to anyone on this message board. So it was somebody at our university.
Someone you knew.
Yeah. I didn't know him.
Oh, you didn't know him?
I didn't know him at the time. I knew friends of his,
oh,
but
wow.
It was like this weird coincidence. And so I wrote a really funny essay about why I needed him, and it was some made-up story about Superman.
Right.
And, you know, I had a bully, neighborhood bully, who took my Superman and jammed it in some dog poop and stabbed me with it, which is actually a true story.
Right. And that's why.
But I ended the joke with the phrase "man of stool."
That's cute.
And he thought it was funny. And then he found out that we knew people, and so I won the ticket. So in this email to this producer at 48 Hours, I said, "And I'm going to be in New York, go by the way, to go see a show because I have tickets, because that's how I roll.
I'm a dedicated fan."
Yeah. So so they basically contacted me pretty quickly, and I wanted to get an internship there. That was the sort of the long game. And I thought this would help me, you know, get noticed. And so Tom basically was my wingman for the trip. Mm-hmm. So the 48 Hours people said, you know, "Let us know when you're going to be in New York. We'll show you around the studio where you worked over in the 50s on the west side.
57th.
Yeah. And then they followed us around with a camera for a few hours, waiting in line to go see Letterman. And after the show, I mean, it was a surreal experience. Everyone was like, "Who are those guys?"
That's amazing.
Yeah. So it was kind of ridiculous. So it turned out, you know, and then they came to GW and filmed me as well. And I thought I was going to, you know.
This was your best.
Yes.
Great.
You know, apply to the internship, send a VHS tape, which that's what we were still on at the time. And I was going to get an internship there. And I was going by, you know, during that time, if you wanted an internship, you had to go to Barnes & Noble and buy these giant books with all the requirements.
With the big book of all the addresses.
Exactly.
Of like where you could, like the big media Bible. Yeah.
Right.
So the one that I had bought had the incorrect deadline. So long story short, I missed the deadline to apply for a late show with David Letterman, and I never worked in late night television ever again. That's not true. But I was devastated. I was devastated for, you know, for about a year. And, you know, Tom and I had this epic trip there. We met, you know, Mujibur and Sarah Jewell and Rupert and the people that, you know, were around there and had a – I think
now,
it was –
quick question.
Yeah.
Did you meet David Letterman?
No, we did not meet David Letterman.
Well, neither did Matt. We worked there for 7 months.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Don't feel bad.
Yeah. So I did not meet him. Okay. But I think it was.
Now you've met David Letterman.
He was here in this room.
So of all the people.
I love it.
You're the only one.
Alec Baldwin did a wonderful interview with Dave, and he brought him out. Check it out at heresthething.org. It's the best interview. And probably the only one that Dave ever gave. It was very good.
When was that? Was that after he left the show?
No, he was leaving. But
he was leaving,
still
but not
there,
quite. Okay, I think I remember reading about that. So shortly after that, you know, I got married sort of pretty quickly after college, about a year out, and lived in D.C. for maybe about 6 years before I moved to New York, which was 11 years ago. About 11 years ago, but was in D.C. for 6 years prior to that. And I would see Tom occasionally, and eventually he got married to a high school friend of ours and has some children now, but has Tom has never come up to New York that I can remember. So yeah, Tom, I don't think has ever come up here. And so I feel
he's only in D.C.?
He's only in D.C. We've seen him down in Maryland, when probably a handful of times, but not a lot. So I still refer to Tom as my best friend, even though, you know, he's technically not. But so the girls make fun of me all the time because I'm like, well, maybe I'll do something with Tom. And so he's sort of become the Rumpelstiltskin or the Canadian girlfriend, the imaginary Canadian girlfriend of best friends, in that I will bring him up whenever I feel like nobody understands me but Tom does. And Tom's my best friend.
No, Tom.
Tom.
Look, he'll be here.
But I think Tom has become one of those people that, you know, he has a family. And also, I think he's maybe a little bit intimidated by the idea of New York.
If you do ever see him again, chances are you'll find that you have nothing to talk about.
Well, the thing about Tom. Well, here's the thing about Tom and why I love him. He has a photographic memory. Oh. So I've forgotten everything about high school, and he's like a walking Wikipedia page on every funny thing I've ever said. So that's one of the great things about Tom.
Yeah, Matt's like that.
Yeah, Matt is exactly it. And actually, Matt reminds me of Tom a bit.
Don't ever argue with Matt because, and I know, he will cite you down to the minute timeline of things that were said and things you said and things he said. And he's always very honest. There's never trying to game the system. Mm. But, yeah, you got to really have all your ducks in a row with Matt.
What does he do with embarrassing memories where he did something stupid or said something stupid?
Oh, we revel in them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They're grist for the podcast. But your friend Tom, yes. I think, you know, it's one of those things where – is it one of those things where if you go down there and you visit, like, it picks up like nothing?
Yes. And it's weird because it's like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe it's so long. And how are we 25 years out of high school now or whatever it is? And
yeah,
so we can definitely pick up where we left off.
A lot of people from BAI, I just couldn't stand. And they, oh, Larry, I remember. And I just, nope.
Yeah. Well, I mean, why do you need to go out in the world? Everybody comes here.
That's true. In fact, I'm pitching New York Magazine a story that I would stay here for a year and see if I could get anything delivered.
Well, now you can.
From a steak to a woman to a major operation.
Hmm. And for only $5.
$5.
I'm going to hear that.
Yeah, you're going to hear about that.
I must say, Jenny, that this is the first I've heard your podcast, and I've heard, in fact, I interviewed you on some of my programs. One of them was, why I can't understand your music.
But, yeah.
But I must say, sitting here watching you work, you are very, very good.
I'm going to crawl under the table.
No, you really are. You're in control. You're interesting to talk to. You're very articulate. And in fact, some people who have heard your podcast say that it's a lot of me and you. So
yeah, I have a model. I have a very good role model for this.
I think it's 23 chromosomes or something like that. But anyway, I'm very proud of you. You're very good at this.
Thank you. Well, you gave me a space to do this when I was 4, right? Yeah. You got the 4-year-old Jenny doing
a station break for
incorrectly
WBAI.
Doing a station break.
Yeah.
Let's not forget, I did it wrong. And then you've got, I listened recently to a clip of 11-year-old Jenny where you were interviewing me about movies that I liked because we had just seen Back to the Future. And when you hear me on this clip, and I'll play it here at some point, I sound like a little Hasidic Jewish girl where I have this like much more of a New York accent or something, or I was trying to be like an intellectual or grown up because I was talking to you and I was terrified. And I was lying about what my favorite movie was. Yeah. My favorite movie at the year and for many years was Back to the Future. But I decided to claim Shock a Lot as my favorite movie. And I look back now and I was just like, I was trying to impress my dad. Oh. And we were talking, it was when we were talking about Roger Rabbit and you didn't like it and I liked it. But like, I can just hear myself. I sound like a little boy in the shul. Like it's really strange and I don't sound like that now. But I could definitely hear myself like putting on a little bit of a show in a way that has taken me probably a lot of years to unlearn. But thank you. That's very kind.
I was amazed that you're so good. And Howard Stern, watch out.
in the classic words of that 80s PSA, I learned it from watching you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you guys both so much. Everybody, go check out the Eric Metaxas show. If it's in your – it's all around the country, right?
It is, yeah.
Yeah. I will listen to it.
Yeah.
I like the fact that you're in radio now.
Yeah, it's fun.
I like that we're all gravitating back to the medium. I ran away from it for several years.
Well,
and if you are a podcaster or you are a radio professional, you could really do no better than the radio. What is the New York studio? The Radio Foundation studio?
Yeah, it's at newyorkstudio.com.
Okay,
and by the way, you could see the slideshow of all the amazing people who have been here.
Yeah, it's incredible. Just go to that website and see the slideshow because whenever I see it, I start having really serious second thoughts about why I moved away. Because Amy Schumer was here last week. That's ridiculous.
She was wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, there are all those stars up on, you know, Sunset and in the canyons that you can buy a map
They're coming right to my house and I'm not here.
Right.
And it sounds beautiful. Like if you listen to that, here's the thing, and you sound how beautiful it sounds. We're just taking the beautiful audio of these fabulous microphones and putting it into my little MacBook Pro. But if you come here, you get the full shebang. It is really a lifetime experience.
And Alec Baldwin, who is very, he is very, very smart.
He's good at podcasting.
Yeah, he's good at interviewing. And one thing he sits in the living room after the show or before the show, and we all schmooze. He's a fabulous mimic.
Yeah.
He can do, and I don't think he's done much of that in public.
Well, just as you know, Chris, because you were hanging around Saturday Night Live all those years. Yeah. He's a fabulous, he could have been a cast member for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's very talented.
And he's always been very kind to me. I mean, in his world, I'm nothing. Or I'm a nobody. Public radio has been. But there's a picture out in the hall of five of the people on who were the stars of WBAI in the 60s, and it was taken by Richard Avedon.
Wow, beautiful.
Who was
I was noticing it on the way in. Actually, I took a photo.
Sometimes Alec will take his guest over and said, point to my picture and says, Larry here, he founded public radio.
Well,
the George Washington.
Exactly. The George Washington of public radio. Yeah. Well, I would estimate that that is true, at least in this pocket of New York City.
Well, of a certain period, yeah.
Yeah. You and Steve and Bob and, you know, I often, when I'm sitting there on podcasts and listening to people basically do free-form radio on these podcasts, I sit there and go, am I the only one that knows that all this has happened before and all this will happen again? And and creating this all for the first time, and every time I hear somebody say, yes, we invented podcasting, I'm like, uh-huh. And then I just, you know, head desk. And
well, I have to say that it was Bob Fass, who was my mentor, and piped me into WBAI, who really invented the style.
Yeah.
He's still doing it.
He's still doing it.
He's 83 years old, and he's still doing it from his home in Staten Island.
Yeah. Well, you have a home studio, too. You should do it, too.
I should, too. This is a great experience. You've been pushing me to do my own podcast, and it's very difficult to get out of my bed where I spent, on my bed where I spent most of the day, walk over here and just talk. And maybe I'll...
Do you have a field kit?
Like a
Zoom or a Marantz or something.
Yeah.
Get a Marantz and a microphone that you can podcast from bed.
My bed, yeah.
Yeah, just call it Larry in bed.
Well, one of my colleagues at BAI, James Ursay, who was brilliant musician and totally crazy, he once did a broadcast from the men's room at WBAI, including all the things that go on in a men's room.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't have the courage.
That was freeform radio at its very best. Just that's the original live stream.
Yeah. More ways than one.
More ways than one. Well, what can I say? It's not at all intimidating to bring your dad into his own radio studio and ask him to tell you a story about lost friends. And he tells you about a place where they used to eat out strippers. Welcome to my childhood. Seriously, though, it was a great time. You know, I was struck thinking about it when Chris was talking about his story, that the very first night that Chris Himes came to New York, or maybe it was the second night, I don't know, but it was really early when he and his other best friend, Ptolemy, came up from Washington, D.C. They slept overnight in this space, this studio where it was like still the studio. And they put down sleeping bags and slept here. And then in the morning, we all went to Sarah Beth's with my dad for breakfast. And I thought, okay, so that was like 20 plus years ago. And they were young and bright with their futures ahead of them. And I was recently returned from college and up here living at my dad's place, wondering what my future held. And 20 plus years later, here was Chris again in the studio, successful radio producer and really great father of six beautiful children. And I don't know, it's sort of amazing. And in it all is one, the only Larry Josephson. He built this incredible radio space out of sheer will and determination. So yeah, that's me signing off from New York City. I'm going to go to therapy now. All right, talk to you next week.